the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. All America is abuzz about certain issues that have emerged over the weekend, certainly. And we have been talking about Hurricane Gustav and its arrival on the Gulf Coast of the United States. But in the midst of all of that, in terms of what was already a very news-intensive Labor Day holiday, there came the news about the Palin family, that is, the family of Alaska Governor Sarah Palin, the vice presidential nominee designate of the Republican Party, and the conversation about the fact that her 17-year-old daughter is now 5 months pregnant without a husband. This has led to a fascinating conversation. I wrote an article posted at my website at albertmohler.com this morning, not dealing so much with the daughter and the baby, a very strong pro-life message being sent there about the daughter's determination to carry the baby to term, the daughter to marry the 18-year-old young man who was the father of this child. You're talking about a family here that just 4 months ago gave birth to a little boy with Down syndrome and made a very strong pro-life statement then, saying that they would not even consider aborting the baby, although many others would. And then we fast forward now to a five-month pregnancy now underway with their 17-year-old daughter, Bristol. Now, in one sense, many people would say it's simply wrong that this is a matter of public discussion. And when it comes to the fact that this is an intensely private matter within the life of a family, there is a great deal of truth to that. Nevertheless, on Friday of last week, when Senator John McCain announced Governor Palin as his running mate, a very private family became a very public issue. And the entire nation shared yesterday some of the awkwardness of all of this and some of the embarrassment of having your public affairs as a family discussed. And thus we find ourselves in the situation of looking at a conversation going on in America right now about what all this means. And that's what we're going to be talking about on the program today. Now, the article I posted this morning at albertmohler.com, and you can go and find the article for yourself, it really deals with the central issue here, not of the daughter, but of the mother, in terms of what this means. How evangelical Christians, for instance, and I've had the press calling me all day about this, how evangelical Christians are going to process this issue and what it means about motherhood, about a woman's role in the church, in the home, and in the society, about a mother's role in terms of helping her daughter into this circumstance and being a mother to a four-month-old baby, much less a four-month-old baby with Down syndrome. We're back to where we started in our conversation on Friday when this announcement was made, and we were just looking at the signals being sent. We're now finding ourselves involved in a national conversation. Now, just to cut to the chase, people have been asking me all day. I've had members of the media and others asking me, what do I think will be the electoral fallout of all this? I think it'll be negligible. I do not believe that American voters are going to take this matter into a weighted consideration of the issues and make the vote one way or the other based upon the announcement made today. I think most American families understand the issue of teenage pregnancy. And as evangelical Christians, we're very clear about what we understand God's plan for sexuality to be. And we know that this family is facing the fact that, that this daughter has conceived, has had this child conceived in her, and yet in solidarity with her is saying now the responsible thing to do is to carry this baby to term. Looking at the issue of the mother here is something that emerged in the New York Times just in the last couple of days. Very fascinating article to which I link from my website, in which the New York Times, of all places, is asking questions about what does this really mean about the role of a mother? What does this really mean in terms of Sarah Palin's ability to juggle all these responsibilities? I think it's the kind of conversation that intelligent evangelical Christians, intelligent Christians ought to be able to have. While we're out there listening to the world talk about this, and there's a lot of chattering going on, I think we ought to have the courage and we ought to seek the clarity to talk about this in terms that really matter to us. Not so much the political calculation. There may be those who may be talking about that ad infinitum. But rather, just what this means in terms of worldview and the picture, what this means in terms of our priorities and values, what this means in terms of excitement about having such a clearly pro-life candidate on this national ticket. And then the sense that, you know, we're in new terrain here. As I said at the end of my article, we need to look hard and we need to think hard about this issue, because this isn't going to be the first time that we're going to be faced with this kind of question, and it won't be the last. So let's talk on this program about what it means for us. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We'll get to your calls in just a moment. First, to review some issues in the news. The September 15, 2008 cover story of Forbes magazine is very interesting. The title of the cover story, The 100 Most Powerful Women in the World. Now, that'll have your attention. I mean, just given the announcement made about Sarah Palin, of course, I have a pretty good idea she would have appeared on this list had this list been made just after Friday. But it turns out that according to the Forbes magazine editors that came together with this, the most powerful woman in the world right now is indeed Angela Merkel, who's the Chancellor of Germany. That makes a good deal of sense. So you're talking about a head of government here who is indeed also the head of state when it comes to Germany, who is clearly a woman elected by her party and then supported by the public. This is what Forbes has to say. A tough gal in a tough spot. Merkel pushed growth in GDP, that is Europe's largest, with $3.3 trillion, to 2.6% last year after stagnation, but a strong euro plus rising prices could slice that in half. Successful reforms, a later retirement age, more women in senior government posts, higher payments for new parents, cuts in greenhouse gases, courting controversy. She has hosted the Dalai Lama, chastised Zimbabwe's Robert Mugabe, and played a nuanced game of engagement and dissing with Russian leaders, having to do with the recent controversy with the nation of Georgia and the breakaway republics there on their borderland. So that's interesting. You know, it's pretty easy to say that one makes sense. Number two on the list of the most powerful women in the world from Forbes is someone you may not have heard of, and that is Sheila Bair, who is the chairwoman of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation of the United States. That's the FDIC. Why is she there? Forbes explains it's because of the attention now given to the FDIC in terms of the failure of several financial institutions just in recent months. Number three, Indra K. Noye, who is chief executive of PepsiCo U.S. Very interesting. PepsiCo sells $45 billion of snacks and drinks, and there it's one of the largest companies to have a woman as CEO. Number four, Angela Braly, chief executive of WellPoint U.S. Number five, Cynthia Carroll, chief executive Anglo-American U.K. Number six, Irene Rosenfeld, chief executive Kraft Foods U.S. Now, the reason I'm reading all these is because most of you probably do not know about many of these women because they're in the business world, known basically to those who are in the business world. Number seven is Condoleezza Rice, Secretary of State of the United States. Now, there are 100 women on this list. You could be looking through them all, trying to figure out what all this means. Hillary Rodham Clinton shows up at 28. Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, at 35. Oprah Winfrey, right after Nancy Pelosi, at spot 36. Melinda Gates, that's Bill Gates' wife, shows up at 40. Laura Bush, the First Lady of the United States, at 44. And you just continue through this list. And here's my point. By the way, Queen Elizabeth II of Great Britain shows up at 58 out of 100. That puts her in the bottom half of that. When you get in the bottom half, you're in a lot of entertainment and media figures. Katie Couric, Barbara Walters, Diane Sawyer, and then some others who were in education and other fields of life. Why bring this up? Well, it's really interesting when you look at this, because this is a list put together by Forbes magazine, which is primarily a magazine of the business class. So when they're looking at the 100 most powerful women in America, they're going to be looking at, of course, those who are the heads of government and heads of state, but also those who are the chief executive officers and major executives of the nation's largest, most powerful, and the world's most influential corporations. But I wonder if most of us were to come up with a list in our own estimation of the 100 most powerful women in the world, my guess is for most of us, this would be a very different kind of list. I think for most of us, we'll be looking in a very different sphere of life. I mean, certainly, talking about the world stage, you'd be talking about people like the Speaker of the House of Representatives, the first woman to hold that role, Condoleezza Rice being only the second woman to hold the role as Secretary of State. You'd be looking at some of the obvious people, such as Queen Elizabeth II. Even though she has a very limited constitutional role, she still holds one of the longest-serving monarchies in the world. But I think most of us, in looking at a list like this, would be thinking about many of the women that would never become known to Forbes magazine. Many of the women that wouldn't be listed in any business journal, but those we know in terms of their vast and incalculable influence in our lives through being mothers and teachers, those who tend to children in the nursery, and in so many, many other areas of life where indeed the hand that rocks the cradle, as the proverb says, rules the world. Back to talk about Governor Sarah Palin and the question of motherhood in a brand new debate. To join the conversation, give me a call at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Coast to coast and with listeners around the world, you're listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. I want to set this whole question up very carefully today because there are a thousand wrong ways we could go with this. And I want to try to help to bring our thinking to a specific focal question. And the background of this is, of course, what happened yesterday. I mean, let's face it, Labor Day 2008 came with a bang. You had Hurricane Gustav that plowed into the Gulf Coast. And then in the midst of all this, the presidential campaign of Senator John McCain revealed that the daughter of Alaska Governor Sarah Palin is 5 months pregnant and yet unmarried. The word did spread quickly, even as Americans were celebrating their end of the summer holiday with an unusual attentiveness to the news. We were all pretty much glued to what was going on, hurricane and otherwise. A statement released by the McCain campaign got right to the point, quoting Governor Palin and her husband Todd. This is what it said, quote, "Our beautiful daughter, Bristol, came to us with news that his parents we knew would make her grow up faster than we had ever planned. We're proud of Bristol's decision to have her baby and even prouder to become grandparents," end quote. So there's a very short statement, and there's a lot said there. There's a lot not said there. But after all, one of the questions we need to face here is to what degree is this family obligated to say a great deal before the public? I mean, obviously, given some of the questions being raised and, frankly, some of the obscenely scurrious rumors being spread about Governor Palin, it was time that the campaign needed to make some statement. And so what was the private concern of a family is now the concern of the public as well. The release that came from the McCain campaign didn't add much to that statement other than the fact that the father is an 18-year-old young man named Levi and that the couple does plan to get married. Now, Steve Schmidt, who's an advisor to Senator McCain, said, and I quote, "Life happens." Mark Salter, who is the co-author of several of Senator McCain's books and is a speechwriter for his campaign, said, quote, "An American family. I suggested that millions of Americans are wondering what's going on here. The Palin family asked to be left to deal with this privately, and that's understandable. But this isn't just any family at present. The moment Senator John McCain announced Governor Palin as his running mate, the entire Palin family became a public issue. This was amplified by the fact that the entire Palin family, except for the eldest son, Track, who is soon to be deployed to Iraq, stood there before the public. One central feature of the public introduction to the Palins was the presence of Trigg, the four-month-old baby boy who was the couple's fifth child. Trigg, in utero, was diagnosed with Down syndrome, and the Palins translated their pro-life beliefs into a beautiful portrait of human dignity. As the couple said, they never even considered aborting the baby, but considered him a gift from God. Well, now they have another gift, and this time in the form of a pregnant daughter and a child conceived outside of marriage. The Palins spoke of their pride in the fact that their daughter would keep her baby and marry the father. Once again, and I think this is very important, the Palin family chooses life over death, birth over abortion, and did so when aborting the baby would be justified by many and considered the easy way out of an embarrassing situation by all too many. Yet that baby is a gift, as is every single living human being, born and unborn. Now, yesterday, the entire nation felt the awkwardness of the situation and even part of the embarrassment. And the embarrassment here is having your family's affairs discussed in public. That, you know, regardless of who your family is or virtually any kind of private matter being discussed, the nation shared in all of this yesterday. Yet, as Steve Schmidt said, life happens. Yes, that's true, but, you know, not always like this. Mark Salter is certainly correct in describing the situation as, quote, "an American family," end quote. But This is not the script many families would choose, especially evangelical families who have been most encouraged by Governor Palin's choice as Senator McCain's running mate. Will this damage the McCain-Palin ticket in November? Well, I would suggest that time will tell, but I think there's good reason to doubt that it will. Teenage pregnancy is hardly unknown these days, and the very public decision to keep the baby will encourage pro-lifers all the more. And I think there's a lot of momentum about that, and this just affirms that issue over and over again. The press is likely to leave this issue alone as soon as possible, simply because I do believe they'll want to respect, insofar as the public will allow, the privacy of this family. Now, I'm suggesting that there's a more interesting angle to the story, and that's what I wrote about at my website at albertmuller.com. In this case, it is the governor as mother that is the issue rather than the daughter. As Jody Cantor and Rachel Swarns of the New York Times framed the issue, and I'm quoting here from their story in the New York Times, when Governor Sarah Palin of Alaska was introduced as a vice presidential pick, she was presented as a magnet for female voters, the epitome of every mom appeal. But since then, as mothers across the country supervise the season's final water fights and pack book bags, some have voiced the kind of doubts that few male pundits have dared raise on television. With five children, including an infant with Down syndrome, and, as the country learned Monday, a pregnant 17-year-old, Ms. Palin has set off a fierce argument among women about whether there are enough hours in the day for her to take on the vice presidency and whether she is right to try. It's the Mommy Wars special campaign edition, but this time the battle lines are drawn inside out, with social conservatives, usually staunch advocates for stay-at-home motherhood, mostly defending her, while some others, including plenty of working mothers, worry that she is taking on too much. End quote. Now, give the New York Times credit for framing that issue in a way most of us can very clearly understand. And I also want to give the reporters credit. I think they talked to a good many people who offered some very well, creditable kinds of opinions on the issue. Now, the whole question about Sarah Palin, not so much as a woman, but as a mother serving in this kind of role, was posed to me by Stephanie Simon of the Wall Street Journal in an interview late last week. And in the news story that was put out by the Wall Street Journal, they said this, and I'm quoting, "So Ms. Palin's decision to accept the nomination for vice president just 4 months after the birth of her disabled son gave pause to a few conservatives, but just for a moment. Quote, if I were her pastor, I'd be very concerned for her and her family," Mr. Mueller said. "But it looks as though she's found a way to integrate it all in a way that works." Well, that is I. I'm speaking there. And I meant what I said then. And I mean it even more now. I think I would have even more cause for pause and for concern now. Now, let me be as clear as I can possibly be about this. Do I believe that a woman can serve well in the office of Vice President of the United States? Yes. As a matter of fact, I believe that a woman could serve well as President and one day will. Portraits of significant men of history hang on the walls of my library, but so do portraits of Queen Elizabeth I of England and former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. I do believe, and this is where many people are trying to figure out, where are you evangelicals on this? And for instance, given all the attention on this program to many of these issues, so people are saying, you know, well, how do you work all this out? Let me be as clear about this as I know I can be. The New Testament clearly speaks to the complementary roles of men and women in the home and in the church, but not in roles of public responsibility. I believe that women as CEOs in the business world and as officials in government are no affront to Scripture. Then again, that presupposes that these women and men have first fulfilled their responsibilities within the little commonwealth of the family. Is this kind of public role what most women want? Clearly not. And honestly, for that I'm very thankful. The tasks assigned to women from within the home are monumental. The maternal role is crucial, and the vast majority of women find their greatest fulfillment in this role, and for good reason. In the roles of wives and mothers, women do what no one else can do so naturally and so well. Well, the New York Times has reported that many, many people are thrilled with the Palin announcement because of so prominent a display of pro-life commitment. Well, count me in on that. I still believe that Governor Palin can, and I believe will, serve with distinction as Vice President of the United States. Still, there's something to give us all pause in this picture, and those who care for the future of the family should take note and think hard and discuss it on this program. To join the conversation, give me a call at 877-893-8255. How do you make sense of all of this? And do you think a legitimate point here is being raised? And how do you work it all out? The number 877-893-TALK. Right back with your calls on the Albert Mueller Program.
listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. I think this ought to be a fascinating conversation. I'd like to know how you're thinking about this, what kind of conversation you're going to be having about this with your own family, perhaps your own kids saying, how does this work? How does she serve as mom and as vice president of the United States if elected? How does all this get put together? I think this has to be a fascinating conversation among a lot of mothers. I've already heard from some of the own of the circles of my own acquaintance that this is an ongoing and fascinating conversation among many women. I'd like to know what you think about this. Just give me a call, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. From Fort Wayne, Indiana, Ron's on the line. Go ahead, Ron.
Yes, thank you. I just wondered, how much time would the vice presidential job actually keep Sarah away from the home?
You know, that's an interesting question, Ron. The constitutional duties of the Office of Vice President of the United States come down, number one, to presiding over the United States Senate and casting the deciding vote when the Senate is split in terms of its vote. The deciding vote that breaks the tie is cast in that role by the Vice President of the United States. As the presiding officer of the Senate, the vice president only votes when it is a tie-breaking vote. You can look at the schedule of the United States Senate and see how often it is in session and for how long. Given the fact that the vice president's not involved in committee work and all the rest of the senators, it's probably a manageable number of hours you could figure into this. Far more important for the vice presidency is the other set of responsibilities that come by the designation of the White House. And in this sense, the vice president serves as an extension of the presidency. You can go back and realize that throughout most of human history, American history there wasn't much in terms of the responsibility of the vice president. Basically, he was on hold. But even the issue of succession wasn't clear in the United States Constitution, and it took some tragedies of the 19th century, actually, to make that very clear. So, nonetheless, you can come to Dwight David Eisenhower, president of the United States in 1953 to 61. And President Eisenhower's vice president was Richard Nixon. And Eisenhower gave to Nixon a considerable amount of responsibility in foreign policy. He made some very, very famous trips, including one that became the substance of a book, very popular back in the 1950s, in terms of Richard Nixon's representation of the United States, also representing the president he served, President Eisenhower. Also, during Eisenhower's illness after a heart attack, in many ways, Richard Nixon took over many of the responsibilities of the presidency. Famous debate, for instance, with Khrushchev. All this a part of Nixon's responsibility. During the Kennedy administration, everyone wanted to know what in the world is Lyndon Baines Johnson going to do. He had been the majority leader of the United States Senate, a man of tremendous power and action. And where was he going to turn that energy? Well, interestingly enough, President Kennedy assigned to him responsibility to direct the space program, which was a major focus of the Cold War after Sputnik. And given the President Kennedy's declared ambition that within the decade, an American would go safely to the moon and safely return. You look then at Hubert Humphrey, a very different role under Lyndon Baines Johnson. And then you look at Spiro Agnew, almost a negligible role. In many ways, he was something of an extension of the spokesman responsibility for the White House, saying things the White House did not directly want to say during the Nixon administration. Gerald Ford then became president of the United States. And then you could look at, for instance, the relationship between William Clinton, the president just immediately passed, and his vice president, Al Gore. Al Gore was given large responsibility for many domestic affairs. And then no one would doubt the fact that when you're looking at Vice President Cheney, you are looking at one of the most powerful men ever to hold that office in terms of the responsibility delegated to him in terms of foreign policy, the war on terror, and all the rest by President George W. Bush. Now, how much time does that take? My guess is if you are indeed Dick Cheney, you're talking about a 24/7 job. If you're talking about Spiro Agnew, something very different. Ron, you raise a very legitimate issue, and that comes down to what right now only John McCain knows. And that is exactly how he intends to deploy his vice president if he's elected president of the United States. But in honesty and in fairness to your question, Ron, I have a very clear idea. There's going to be a lot of time. There is travel that is the responsibility. You know, at one point, it was George H.W. Bush himself who said that the vice president of the United States spends a great deal of his time attending the funeral of dead Soviet leaders. That vice president found that a major part of his job responsibility during the Reagan administration. Let me know what you're thinking about this, and not just a woman as vice president, but a mother as vice president. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We'll be right back.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mohler Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. An awful lot of moms have been discussing this. How do you juggle all this? How do you put all this together? Just getting all the kids ready for the new school year and making everything happen, even getting the kids to church, you know, all this can seem just a monumental challenge and often is. Add to that being vice president of the United States, a lot of people are asking the question, how does that work exactly? I'd like to know what you're thinking about this. The phone number is 877-893-8255. Will this influence your vote? Is this just a matter of some kind of external interest saying, I wonder how she pulls that off? I wonder how that would happen. She's now the governor of Alaska, no small job. She's been involved in all kinds of things. I think most moms would say, I can't imagine being mayor and mom, much less governor and mom, and then perhaps even vice president and mom. I think this is an issue unto itself. The first response to the whole issue of her announcement was, of course, just great celebration over her pro-life credentials among many evangelical Christians. The follow-up question is, okay, what's the bigger picture, and how does this all fit together? The phone number to join the conversation is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. All right, let's go to Lakewood, New York. Marty's on the line. What are you thinking, Marty?
I'm thinking that I think it's wonderful and exciting that John McCain would think outside of the box and choose a mother of five. But as a citizen, I think it was irresponsible to put the country at risk with a person of such little experience.
That's interesting. Just the experience question. I guess one obvious thought, you know, that comes to mind here, Marty, when I think about that, is that, a mother of five is possessed of a different kind of experience, a different set of experience than someone who might come from the business world or from other service. Those who would defend her experience would point to the fact that she is, after all, the elected governor of a state with executive responsibility. It's interesting. It really depends, I guess, upon what kind of experience you're looking for. And, the McCain campaigns made the issue of Senator Barack Obama's relative short tenure in the United States Senate. So you can be sure they're going to press back on Governor Palin on this, a relatively short tenure as a governor of a state. You're going to have the McCain camp shoot back and say, yes, but that's an executive responsibility. She's formed a budget, proposed a budget, managed a budget. She's got thousands of employees under her employ. She has responsibility for representation of a state in terms of especially economic relationships with foreign countries, not to mention 49 other states. And so it's very interesting. You're going to have the Obama campaign press back again, saying, as they said, I think, and not too wisely in the original response, you know, that she was the mayor of a city of some 9 or 10,000 people. Politics is a moving target, and both of these campaigns are going to be making the best argument they can come up with at the moment. And Marty raises the experience issue, and certainly it's a different set of experiences, no doubt about it, which I think gets back to the main issue I wanted us to talk about, which is the whole motherhood angle. Motherhood's an experience. It's not the traditional trajectory to the Oval Office, or for that matter, to the vice president's office there in the executive office building, either the Teddy Roosevelt room, as I recall. All right, let's go to Dan calling from Farmington, New Mexico. Go ahead, Dan.
Yes, sir. First of all, I'd like to say that his decision on choosing Miss Palin, Mrs. Palin, was a great idea, but everybody's talking like she's a single mom. She's she's not a single mom. Obviously, she has a wonderful husband that supports her and helps raise those kids, so she's not single.
Yeah.
If she were single, yeah, I could understand there would be some hard decisions, but she has a wonderful husband that's supporting her, and it probably has helped get her where she's at today.
Yeah, I think we lost you, Dan, there, but let's put it this way. I'm absolutely certain she couldn't be where she is today without Todd Palin's very active support, and he was there just as proud as he could be when the announcement was made on Friday. And I thought one of the most interesting lines in Governor Palin's address was where she referred to Todd, it was their 20th wedding anniversary after all, as the man she then and now most admires in the world. And that's a pretty strong statement. You know, what I wrote in my article and what I said to the Wall Street Journal on Friday is that it's clear, it's transparently clear that this family has found a way to work all this out. And I can respect that. I can understand that. I still have to say, just given my concerns, I think it'd be a tough thing to pull off. And I say that as a husband and as a father, I think it'd be a very tough thing to pull off. I'm not saying that I wouldn't vote for Governor Palin to be Vice President of the United States. Given her positions on the issues, I find that I pretty much am drawn immediately to support the one who holds to that kind of position. No secret to those of you listening to this program. I just want to be honest and say, look, this isn't uncomplicated. This isn't uncomplicated at all. As a Christian who believes in biblical roles for men and women, and again, I believe that a woman can serve as a CEO of a corporation, as vice president, or as president of the United States. I just believe, and I know this is going to sound condescending to some, and will sound just ridiculous to others. I just don't think that's the highest office that a woman can hold. And I'll be honest, I think that the role of wife and mother is far more important and fundamental even than that. Not saying she shouldn't serve. I'm just saying that at the end of the day, her greatest impact is likely to be inside that family rather than outside that family. And someone's going to turn back and say, well, that's sexist. Well, let me come back and say, I think that's true of fathers too. Even though I think God does give to men an assigned responsibility in the culture, just in terms of the fact that men are freed from many of the maternal responsibilities, which both biologically and socially come down to a mother's maternal instincts, functions, responsibilities, and role. So you look at all that and you say, how do you put this together? I don't think there's any magic wand to just kind of wave over this issue so that everything's neat and tidy. And by the way, I don't think politics is that way. I don't think the human life is that way. I don't think that elections are that way. And in a Genesis 3 world in which each one of us is a sinner, I don't think looking in the mirror, it's that easy. We sometimes don't even know our own abilities and how we balance things. We sometimes look in the mirror and wonder how we pull off being faithful in different spheres of life. I certainly know I sometimes just look in the mirror and wonder, all right, father, husband, seminary and college president, doing other things that I do. You know, how do I make sure I'm faithful in every dimension of that life? I can tell you, though, I'd be daunted by the adding a vice president of the United States to that role, and my guess is any sane person would be. But I'm thankful, nonetheless, that there are men and women ready to run for that office and to serve in that role for all of us. How you work all these things out? I'll be the first to admit, I don't think there's any way to wrap it all up in a neat package and say, there it is. Back of final thoughts, this is the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. Just some final thoughts on this. You look at the press coverage of the whole issue here, and you find some bizarre things. At On Faith, of which I'm an occasional participant there at the Washington Post, David Waters has written an article entitled Southern Baptists and Their Gender Double Standard. This is what he says. Now that Southern Baptist leaders are embracing the idea of a woman leading this nation, will they rethink their rejection of the idea of a woman leading their congregations? Probably not. He goes on and covers recent Southern Baptist statements on this. And then he comes back and says, as it always has amused me that there seems to be only one fundamental in which the male leaders of conservative Roman Catholic, evangelical, and Pentecostal, Protestant, Mormon, Orthodox, Jewish, and Muslim denominations all agree. A woman cannot lead their congregations or denominations. Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, yes. The Right Reverend Margaret Thatcher, no. President Mary Robinson, yes. Reverend Mary Robinson, no. Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto, yes. Imam Benazir Bhutto, no. Prime Minister Golda Meir, yes. Rabbi Golda Meir, no. President or Vice President Sarah Palin, yes. Pastor Sarah Palin, never. Now, this is what he says next, and listen to this. He says, how do these guys keep a straight face? How do they explain this to their American daughters? Honey, in America, you can grow up to be anything you want except the pastor of our church, end quote. After Palin's selection, it will be interesting to see how they explain this double standard to American voters, end quote. That's reading there from the article Southern Baptists and Their Gender Double Standard at On Faith, the Washington Post Newsweek, the article by David Waters. Well, since I am one of the they referenced here when he says it'll be interesting to see how they explain this double standard to American voters, let me say I would explain it this way. I don't believe that the New Testament speaks to the issue of a woman serving as CEO of a corporation or as president or vice president of the United States at all. I don't believe there is any reference to this. There are many positive references, commands to a woman fulfilling her responsibility, whether you're looking at Ephesians 5 or Titus 2, very clear references there to a woman's role within the home, but it doesn't exclude a public role beyond that. When he says here, how do these guys keep a straight face? How do they explain this to their American daughters? Honey, in America, you can grow up to be anything you want except the pastor of our church. It comes down to the fact that we do believe that the Bible speaks very clearly to the fact that it is not our decision, but God's decision that the pastor be limited to men. Now, if it comes down to the question, how do we keep a straight face? Well, I'll keep my face straight when I tell you, as straight as I can, that I believe the Bible clearly lays that out in unmistakable terms. And because I am a Christian and must be obedient to the Word of God, I have to be obedient to that. That's what I would tell my daughter, even as she's watching the news about a woman being nominated to be Vice President of the United States. There's a difference in the role between a Vice President and a pastor, and I think we all know it. Back tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.